We'd like to acknowledge that this meeting is being held on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. In 1980, the anthropologist Victor Turner proclaimed, "By their performances shall ye know them." A performance, writes Turner, is declarative of our shared community, our shared humanity, yet it utters the uniqueness of particular cultures. We will know one another better by entering one another's performances and learning their grammars and vocabularies. Australian drama has for a long time been preoccupied by a search for identity that has been informed by a series of colonisations and vigorous resistances to these influences. So in this session, I and my fellow performers, who I will introduce at the end of the session, will focus on the enactment of identity in Australian drama from 1955 to the present. The session consists of two distinct elements: an introduction and running commentary provided by me, and performed readings of 12 short excerpts from Australian plays, starting with Ray Lawler's The Summer of the 17th Doll in 1955, premiering in 1955, and finishing with a new play by Angela Betsine, which will premiere at the Victorian College of the Arts in August this year. These segments, a couple of which consist of two scenes fused together, have been selected and rehearsed by my colleague at the VCA, Marcel Dorney. Any identity narrative that bases itself around uncontextualised fragments of a small handful of Australian plays over this period, in fact, any single narrative at all that purports to plot the changing face of Australian identity as expressed in drama, is inevitably selective, incomplete and contestable. So, what the hell, we might as well be bold about it. When a dramatic character steps into the performance space, both we in the audience and other characters tend to ask something like, who are you and why are you here? Victor Turner noted that performance involves a public reflexivity. And as Nadine Holdsworth writes in Theatre and Nation, the way a nation sees itself and projects itself to others is tied up in the narratives a nation tells itself about itself, including both the what and the how. And this is an important point. It's not only the content, characters, behaviour and aspirations depicted in drama, but the form in which that content and behaviour is expressed that performs culture and identity. For aesthetic form embodies assumptions about shared cultural values, worldview, recognisability and so on. Changes in dramatic form will be evident during the segments that we present this afternoon. So the nature of the association between theatre and identity is actually very complex. Turner points out that in performance, the contents of group experiences are replicated, dismembered, remembered, refashioned, and mutually or vocally made meaningful. Performance reflects culture and identity, and in certain instances also reflects on culture and identity. Or put differently, drama and theatre performs culture, including in ways that the playwrights and other makers may not be fully aware of at the time, and at the same time stages, at least at times it stages, a reflexive and sometimes critical intervention into its own culture and sense of national identity. So furthermore, it is a particular nature of drama and theatre to resist all singular concrete determinations. Statements by and depictions of characters are always presented and understood within the context of the scene, in the context of the whole play, in the context of their interactions with others, where in the arc of the play they do and say these things, the context of that particular production, audience expectations at that particular moment, you know, and so on and so on. One of the reasons for this is, as Martin Puchner points out, the medium is both a performing art in the sense that it relies on the physical presence of human beings executing their artistry in the way that musicians play instruments or dancers dance. It's also a mimetic art in that it turns these performing human beings, along with stage props and light and space and so on, into material used for the purpose of representation. So a table on stage is both a table, a representation of a table, and it's also a real table, an element in an aspect of the performing art. A character who is a recognisable Australian identity is both a representation of an existing or newly invented Australian identity and at the same time an actual person, that is the actor, interacting in various ways with the other actors, looking a certain way, inflecting and problematising that recognisable Australian identity at the same time as he or she is representing it. Holdsworth argues that theatre is in fact particularly potent when it contests the homogenous national image, when it opens up a creative space for exploring the paradoxes, ambiguities and complexities around issues of tradition, identity, authenticity and belonging associated with the nation. As Jack Hibbard writes in 1979, the theatre tends naturally to evocations and signs rather than statements and maps. It encourages a more active, less supine range of creative audience response. So in this spirit, the play segments that we will present in this session will be almost entirely uncontextualised. Instead, for the most part, apart from this initial introduction, I will quote from essays and reviews that, being roughly contemporary in most cases to the plays, reveal the search for identity in different ways to the plays themselves. So this kind of presentation asks you, the audience, to join the dots in your own way. But by way of setting the scene, the reasons for starting this survey in 1955 are numerous. In 1949, English director Tyrone Guthrie presented a contentious report on the state of theatre in Australia, in which he proposed that leading overseas companies be brought to Australia to establish appropriate standards, and that Australian actors and directors serve apprenticeships abroad. In 1955, the Australian Elizabethan Theatre Trust was founded to, quote, educate the public via a range of classical revivals, and with the aim of, quote, establishing national drama, opera and ballet companies employing local artists. So tellingly, one of the Trust's first actions was to stage a remount of a 1947-48 US production of Euripides' Medea, with Australian-born US-bred Judith Anderson in the lead role. The production was redirected by another English director, Hugh Hunt, who was appointed the first director of the Trust, executive director of the Trust, and his appointment was also telling, of course, since he was not only himself not an Australian, but he's quoted as saying that he, quote, knew very little about Australia and probably less about the Australian theatre. In 1953, the Union Theatre Repertory Company, later called the Melbourne Theatre Company, was founded here at the University of Melbourne, and by 1955 had established itself as the first professional theatre company in Australia. Initially founded on the English repertory model and staging British, American and European plays, the company produced its first new Australian play in 1955, Ray Lawless' Summer of the 17th Doll, regarded by many as the first truly Australian play. So Summer of the 17th Doll shows an archetypal Australian masculinity, the working white man as conqueror of the landscape, at the very moment, both in the lives of the characters and the dream life of Anglo-Australia, when that archetype enters its final crisis.
In the front room of a shabby Carlton townhouse, Olive leans against a piano, beer in hand, and looks out through the lace curtains at the warm December evening.
You told me yourself they hardly ever write to you, from the time they go away till the time they come back.
They don't have to write me. I know where they are, working their way through up north.
Yeah, but at least they could let you know how they're getting on.
What? Cutting sugarcane? What can they say about that? Roo's one of the best men they've got, runs his own gang, but even down here you'd never get him yapping about his season's tally. That's all his part of it.
Well, it beats me how you can stand it. I know with Wally I used to worry all the time. Even if he was late home from work, I used to worry.
With these, you don't have to. These are men. Not the sort we see rolling home to their wives every night, but men.
I know, you keep telling me. I never knew there was any difference.
You never knew. Nancy used to say it was how they walked into the pub as if they owned it. Even just the way they walked, you could spot it. All round would be the regulars, soft city blokes, having their drinks and their little arguments, and then in would come Roo and Barney. They wouldn't say anything. Oh, they didn't have to. There'd just be the two of them walking in, then a kind of wait for a second or two and quiet. After that, without a word, the regulars would stand aside to let them through just as if, Oh, as if they were a couple of kings. She always reckoned they made the rest of the mob look like a bunch of skinned rabbits. poor old Nancy.
Well, she got what she wanted, didn't she?
Oh, I'd like to ask her. Right now, with them expected any minute and her sitting up chained to that book bloke, I'd like to ask her if she thinks it was all worth it. And I bet that'd be one question she wouldn't be able to laugh her way out of.
Well, you know her. I don't. Sorry if I put you out.
Nah. It's my fault for flying off the handle. It was just for a moment there you sounded like my mother. She's fond of Roo, you know, but every time he's away we have a row. Emma throws him up at me like a dirty dishcloth every time.
I know, an aunt of mine was like that. Used to store everything up and then let it rip at family funerals.
Ah, chronic. Yeah, doesn't it make you mad?
She what? Switches on a lamp.
They just want to make trouble, really.
Meh, that's all. Here, empty that and let's have another.
Oh, no, you have it. I haven't even started this yet. No. Feeling a bit gassy.
Come on, we have to get rid of this bottle, otherwise they're going to think we started off without them.
Listen.
What?
She rushes to the window as a car horn sounds in the middle of the distance.
Oh, too late? That's them now.
Ruth Grant, wrote in 1958.
The most important pressure on the Australian theatre today is that of ordinary Australians who want to see themselves on the stage. The Australian playwright has forced his way into the limelight and is shouting out something that his compatriots have heard only faintly or intermittently before. He is saying that their lives are fascinating, that everything they do is significant. I think that for a while anyway, Australian playwrights will produce simple, human plays, warm, touchingly sentimental. We have no sense of history, nor do we have a sense of tragedy. We are too busy to think on the pain of being a man. We are strong about physical pain and social suffering, but spiritual isolation and contempt are not yet widely discussable subjects. We will be disappointed if we expect theatre to create a drama of concentrated intellect and emotion like the best in Europe. Hugh Hunt, 1960, critiquing the state of Australian playwriting. Conflict and emotions are at the heart of all drama, but conflict can only be expressed by articulate people. When realism descends to the inhabitants of the backyard, conflict has to be couched in monosyllables and emotions have to take the form of physical violence. It is difficult to think of any Australian play which does not end up with a blue. Leonie Kramer, 1960. The Australian audience is neither as naive nor as ignorant as Mr. Hunt seems to suppose. In Patrick White's The Season at Sarsaparilla, 1962, the everyday activity, petty arguments and silent desperation of three adjacent households in post-war suburban Sydney are refracted through Patrick White's eyes. For the first time, ordinary Australian life is shown to be not simply the subject of a unique artistic vision, but the origin of it.
Roy Child appears along the lane. He is looking sunburned. He leans against the proscenium arch and looks at the setting. Three platforms representing the kitchens and backyards of three suburban houses in Mildred Street, Sarsaparilla.
When summer closes its door on chalk dust and foxy questions of 40 children, the mind should find release. But it doesn't. Nobody who has been boxed is ever quite free. His thoughts home, like pigeons to roost on their familiar perches with the box thoughts of those he has never really left. Here I am then, smelling of salt, sun, and seaweed capsules popped in the heat of day. Wearing its glaze of summer, my body is more or less renewed. While my thoughts and mind lurks in stuffy corners filled with Genoa velvet and silky oak veneer. Where the body ignores, the mind reminds that the radio hasn't left off playing in empty rooms, that the TV will continue to dissolve human personality like gelatin in tepid water. Of course, we who know all this hate it and promise ourselves to escape to something better, but wonder if that exists and depend on those twin dazzlers, time and motion, to help us believe we are doing
and being. Who can resist deceiving himself when the razzle-dazzle is on?
A razzle-dazzle of light is played on the proscenium, the effect of a blind flapping, light flickering through its slats. Movement becomes shorter, sharp, stylized, like the motion of figures in a silent film. A violin is heard from the house in the middle, playing something firm, gay, and a trifle harsh.
Here they go now. That nice girl, Judy Pogson, just can't give up the violin away. She won an instrumental section once. At night, her dreams breathe music. Its curtains hides whatever she has to discover.
Mavis Knott comes into the kitchen on the left and scrapes vegetables in obvious discomfort.
All afternoon, my sister Mavis will have had the wind. Her time is getting close. This evening, she could kill the carrots.
The sounds of dogs barking is heard.
And the dogs. The dogs have never really stopped barking in anybody's mind.
Pippi Pogson appears in the middle kitchen. She has a mission. She runs down the back steps.
Pippi, where are you off to?
Nowhere. I'm going to muck around in the street a bit.
Not now, dear. We'll be having tea very soon.
She goes on, however, toward the garden. Deirdre has come in from the street. She whispers into Pippi's ear. They both laugh loud and run off towards the street.
Looking for something to do. Looking for something to do. A lot of it is strictly necessary, of course. But above all, it's something to do.
Dorothy Hewitt, 1976. Patrick White made his brief entry into the theatre for four plays and broke the spell of naturalism. Using expressionism, symbolism and poetic language in the Australian theatre for the first time, he created unforgettable archetypes. Then in 1968, at Betty Burstall's ex-shirt factory, La Mama, the Australian theatre really took off. It was a name and a concept borrowed, like most Australian new ideas, from somewhere else. David Kendall, 2007, looking back at 1967 and the first production of Jack Hibbert's White with Wire Wheels. We plastered up around the university, auditions, new Australian play. We held three auditions and nobody turned up for the auditions. And that was the state of Australian drama then. Nobody took it seriously. The first night of White with Wire Wheels, up came Mal, Rick Thorpe, and Root My Boot, What a Night. And the audience almost gave a yelp of recognition. Christ, it's the metropolitan urban voice of our age, and they got it immediately. Rather than our outback bush types, suddenly there were these metropolitan yuppies before the term had been invented. We realised then that there was an audience in and around Carlton for a new kind of theatre, one that spoke to the young Carltonians. And in fact, in that quote, which I haven't got here, there is mention of one, Patrick McKechnie, as being instrumental in getting an Age printed in a review printed in The Age. David Williamson, 1972. The so-called APG, or Australian Performing Group, had arrived. Physical, raucous, two-dimensional, and generating real theatrical energy in performance. Len Radick, 1979. A distinctly Australian brand of theatre. Rough, raw, vaudevillian, highly physical and intelligent. Graham Blundell, 2009. Once banned in three Australian states and the subject of an infamous censorship battle that saw actors and directors arrested for public obscenity, Alex Buzo's controversial Norm and Ahmed was the first local play to examine Australia from an Asian viewpoint.
Norm and Ahmed by Alex Buzo, 1967.
Brings a middle-aged white Australian face-to-face with a young university student from Pakistan and shows how egalitarian sentiment of the fair go for all doesn't just coexist with racist violence, but does so in mutual dependency.
A Sydney street in summer, nearly 1 o'clock in the morning. Norm has been talking for some time.
I'm on my own too, and I know what it's like. A young bloke like your age ought to be out and about, mixing with people, getting amongst the girls. Well, you know what your trouble is, Ahmed, don't you?
What?
You're too shy. That's the first thing I noticed about you. You're too shy.
You think so?
Well, of course, it's obvious.
Well, it's true, I do not have many friends.
Look, I'll tell you what, Ahmed. Why don't you go up to the New South Wales Leagues Club? You know, have a good time. Mention my name and to the bloke on the door, you'll be in like the proverbial Flynn. Just tell him Norm sent you. That's all you got to do. Go up with your mates and get on the hops. You'll soon get to know the blokes up there. A great mob they are too. And I've got a feeling they'll take to you, Ahmed. I think you'll go down well.
Thank you, Norm. I shall bear that in mind.
Yeah, you do that, Ahmed. You do that. I'd like to see you meeting some people, making some friends. Loneliness is a terrible curse, Ahmed. And I'd like to see you coming out of your shell. And we're not such a bad mob out here, you know? We're a bit on the rough and ready side, but our heart's in the right place.
Oh, I've had ample proof of that.
And as I said, Ahmed, you really ought to give a thought of staying out here. Find yourself a good woman. You know, something more than just a weekend route, and settle down and have a family. Buy a weekender down the coast, join the local leagues club. You know, they've improved a lot, those clubs. 20 years ago, they weren't much chop, but geez, nowadays, what a difference. Anyway, Ahmed, there it is. Good prospects. You could have a good time. I mean, what more could you ask for? This place would be made for a bloke like you.
Well, I think I will concentrate on completing my tertiary education first. My primary concern is to obtain a liberal education, and my secondary concern is to gain a deeper understanding of human behaviour.
Yeah, that's fair enough. But keep it in mind, Ahmed. I mean, we'd love to have you, and the people, they take you into their hearts. You know, everyone from Alice Springs to breakfast time. It'd be a red carpet job.
Thank you very much, Norm. That is very nice of you. I must say, I have received some warm hospitality from a lot of people since I've been in your country. It is most gratifying. Of course, not everyone has extended this hospitality towards visitors from Eastern backgrounds, such as myself.
Ah, well, you got to take the rough with the smooth. I mean, there's rat bags wherever you go. But the majority of people do the right thing. I think you'll go well down out here.
Thank you again, Norm. I certainly hope so. You've given me something to think about.
Glad to hear it. Well, Ahmed, I must say it's been a pleasure to meet you and have this little talk. I mean, to reach a common understanding. I mean, that's what the world needs, I reckon. A bit of common understanding.
That is very true. I've enjoyed meeting you too, Norm. It has been a real pleasure.
I'll put it there, mate.
Yes, I...
Norm punches Ahmed in the stomach, then in the face. He grabs Ahmed's head and bashes it against the post. Then he flings the limp body over the fence.
Fucking boom.
The clock strikes one. Blackout.
And with those last two words, particularly the second last one, the police arrived and people were arrested. Jack Hibbert, 1970. Australian theatre's relationship with its society is essentially chimerical. That is to say, it is grafted, artificial, parasitic. Instead of being both demotic and dialectical, it is hieratic and imposed. Middlebrow, middle class, and middle-aged tastes are generally catered for. These are pseudo-intellectual, liberal, and genteel. An intelligent, radical, and uncouth theatre is called for. An intelligent, radical, and uncouth theatre is required, a theatre that is rich, relevant and ribald. Only then will we hear our own tongue, not the mythico-literary language concocted in the past. Clothes must be shed, shanks displayed, and footwork put to the test. This is the strategy for a new, young and potent theatre. Catherine Brisbane, 1971. In Dorothy Hewitt's new play, The Chapel Perilous, a woman for the first time shows a mixture of gargantuan appetite for life and the waste of ill-directed energy. The Chapel Perilous by Dorothy Hewitt, 1971, is a sprawling, hilarious, highly personal epic of self-realisation. More than any other play here, the author illuminates the national character by the intensity of her protagonist's struggle against it.
Girls and boys dance to pop tunes of the 1940s. Amongst them is Sally Banner, in a red dress and flying beads. The voice of Sister Rosa is heard.
Atheist, pacifist, communist, blasphemer, She whored her youth away, and there was no peace in our time.
I will give her a reference, because as far as I know, she is a clean, living Christian girl.
And everyone's talking about Sally Banner's Grand Slam, first, second, and third in the Jindy Werribut poetry competition. Mrs. Banner, I believe Sally was live wire in her university days.
Well, no more than most, really. They were unsettling times. The Americans were here, lacing our daughters' milkshakes with Spanish fly. It turned their heads. We were all worried about our daughters. What decent mother wouldn't? She was a real trollop. She'd lie down anywhere and do it like a dog. It was as if she wanted to punish us for something. Why? What had we done? We'd only loved her and protected her.
Stopped her making a fool of herself.
You must be a very proud father, Mr. Banner.
They said she had talent. I don't know. I never read poetry myself. Highbrow sort of stuff. I don't know where she got it from. Nothing like that in my family. She had big ambitions, wanted to get away, but the war came. I said, better be a big frog in a small puddle, Sal. We didn't see eye to eye on much. Understand her? I'd seen bitches on heat like her during the war, but it's rough when it's your own. Man mad, couldn't keep her pants on. She had it in for us ever since I bashed that young bastard's skull in with a 2x4.
After all we'd done for her.
In the morning, I'd come down to breakfast. How are you, Sal? Great day.
The world tastes like blood in my mouth.
How do you deal with that?
She was sick, that's what I said. Better get her straight to a doctor.
Sally Banner, take an ink blot test.
I see a vagina ringed with decayed teeth.
Very interesting, dear.
I see a penis studded with 6-inch nails.
Fascinating, dear.
I see an avenue of black bums copulating in the gloom. I want to be a second Edith Sitwell.
I think you're trying to have us on, dear.
I'll be greater than Sarah Bernhardt.
All adolescents go through a period of role-playing. The only cure is time. Try to be patient. Never admit how shocked you really are.
The music and dancing fade.
I smelt semen on your pants last night, Sally.
I believe strongly in the blood, the flesh, as being wiser than the intellect.
Hot bath, morning and midnight, just to bring it on. What a wicked waste.
We can go wrong in our minds, but what our blood feels and believes and says is always true.
I took a look in your locker. The Tropic of Cancer, cigarettes and contraceptives.
All I want is to answer to my blood direct.
Sally removes her shoe and throws it at her mother.
Daddy! Daddy, look what she's doing now!
I'll answer you, you bitch!
He shakes her.
Whore! Dirty whore!
Sally slaps his face.
I'm going now, with a copy of D.H. Lawrence and a spare pair of pants.
I'll let her go. She'll come home when she's hungry.
Oh, Sally! Sally! Don't leave us! Come home,
even
darling!
Even the genius has got to eat!
Catherine Brisbane, 1971. We still are the inheritors of that essentially vulgar and working class society, founded by a population of convicts and work evaders, militarists and opportunists, with the vitality, impudence, disorderliness and ignorance that goes with these things. The recognition of this is to be found in the plays of Rodney Milgate, Jack Hibbard, Alexander Buzo, John Romerill, Dorothy Hewitt. They are rorty, wasteful, intensely colloquial scripts, and they make one realise how foreign is clever construction, eloquence and precision in this country. They also show, to an awesome degree, how rich, vivid and accurate our colloquial tongue is. For years we have called ourselves inarticulate because we do not, as a nation, speak the tongue that Sir Robert Menzies speaks. In Jack Hibbard's A Stretch of the Imagination, 1972, hailed by Catherine Brisbane at the time as the first genuine dramatic classic Australia has produced, Monk O'Neill's surreal, satirical reassessment of his past glories and iniquities captures a culture grappling with its myths at the moment of rapid and overdue change.
Monk O'Neill, a man of indeterminately advanced years, appears at the door of his hut. A 4-gallon drum stands in his yard.
Glad rags.
He dashes forward.
Thought I saw something. a steamroller, speeding along, discharging red smoke. Go on. Could have been a snowplow. Reminds me of the time Les Darcy and I scaled Mount Kosciuszko. Les was in training at the time for his first clash with another fine exponent of the leather, Jess Smith. There we were, gazing over our fair land. Australia. Attired only in slouch hats and boxing trunks. Our bare feet commingling with the soft, thin snow. Well, young Les, somewhat overcome by the grandeur of the khaki expanse before him, intimated to me a vision of the future. Monk, he said, one day, Australia, that great nation of soldiers and sports and athletes, cereals and wool, will one day rule the Pacific. I believe that. England will lick the elastic on our boots. America will extend to us an equal hand. The Indon and the Kanaka, we will civilise. Out there, O'Neill, lies a germ. The germ of the future. With water and work, will grow and spread and breed into an empire of fair play and health and wealth and literature and wealth and power. He had tears in his eyes. I took him by the south paw. Cut it out, Les. You cannot extract sunbeams from a cucumber. The lack of oxygen has snapped your intellect. Come on, put up those dukes and we'll go a round or two for a pound or two. It's as cold as a cunt on concrete. Ah, oh, above the belt, Les. Remember Fritz Holland.
The spar, now a fight, continues until Monk is floored. He lies unconscious.
KO. That's no way to treat a sparring partner, a distant cousin, a long-lost friend. That's no way to treat Australia, said Les, and walked off down into Perisher Valley.
Jack Hibbard, 1979, discussing the prevalence of one-character plays in Australia. I believe this brand of play is relatively dominant in Australia because we do not as yet have a national culture, shared assumptions that make us feel Australian. Because we are still an awkward social agglutinate, special modes of rootlessness and asocial isolation obtain. Dramatists then are naturally drawn to individual characters who seek to create their own history, their own legends and significance, sometimes with ironic colouring since it is their own invention. Dorothy Hewitt, 1976. Existing theatre superstructures in Australia, whether establishment or alternative, tend to be exclusionist, bitchy and ungenerous to those outside their own groups. One of the most difficult positions as a writer has been to be a woman playwright. There has been reflected a deep fear of sexuality, and the result has been a series of female stereotypes in the plays. Bitches, sex objects, mother figures, the excuse being that men find it difficult to write about women. Malcolm Robinson, 1977. The most important and far-reaching achievement during the last 10 years has been the development and encouragement of the Indigenous playwright. Kulak by Indigenous writer Jack Davis, 1979. Staged only a dozen years after Indigenous Australians had been afforded proper citizenship in the 1967 referendum, employs a flexible and responsive theatrical technique that captures the urgency of a long overdue story, the struggle of the first Australians against invasion and occupation.
In 1901, after 72 years of European settlement, the population of the colony of Western Australia has increased to 180,000.
Congratulations.
Not including the Aboriginal race. Their numbers have been reduced by half, from 55,000 to 24,000.
What happened to the other 31,000?
Owing to natural decrease. It is expected that, like their Tasmanian counterparts, they will eventually die out. On the other hand, the half-caste population is increasing alarmingly. By 1920, there are 2,000 of them, and by 1935, 4,000. The government is now faced with a half-caste problem as well as an Aboriginal problem.
Or a white problem.
The new government is tackling the issues with committees, inquiries, legislation, regulations, investigations, and a new government department headed by a chief protector of Aborigines.
It is my opinion that these half-castes can be made into useful workmen and women. But unfortunately, they are most often found in communities whose influence is towards laziness and vice. And I think it is our duty not to allow these half-castes, whose blood is, after all, still half-British, to grow up as vagrants and outcasts as their mothers now are. A half-caste who possesses a few of the virtues and all of the vices of whites grows up to be a mischievous and criminal subject. It may appear to be cruel to take an Aboriginal child from its native mother, but it is necessary, in some cases, to be cruel in order to be kind.
The police.
The police? The police would just arrive and take the child and put him on a reserve or a mission where he could learn to live white, to assimilate. While the children played in the settlement compound, huge wire fences, concentration camp fence, the old woman would come up and call them over, hold their little hands through the compound fence and tell them who they were, who their mothers were, what their skin name was, and what their totems and dreamings were. The children were caught, belted by the authorities and told not to mix with those dirty blacks.
John McCallum, 1986. It's only in the last 20 years that an attempt has been made to analyse the broader social, political, economic and historical forces which influence individual action. A range of players today are engaged in creating new structures for the purpose of reassessing the past. It is no coincidence that while some players are radical restatements of the relations between Australia and Japan, others are reassessments of Australian history in terms of Aboriginal culture and experience. Peter Fitzpatrick, 1986. The energies of community theatre, as indeed of women's theatre and black theatre, and of the many of those groups experimenting radically with new forms of theatre and styles of playing, seem to me now to offer strong grounds for pronouncing the patient vigorously well. A great diversity of practice has been the feature of the last 9 years. But the difficulty of playwrights in finding a suitably productive form point to some important changes in direction in Australian drama, and raise a number of associated questions about the place, if any, of a continuing preoccupation with cultural definition and about the adequacy of old stereotypes and satiric styles. These next three excerpts will run one after the other without commentary. Too Young for Ghosts by Yanis Bolotis, 1985, places the experience of post-World War II immigrants to Australia in the same theatrical landscape as Ludwig Leichhardt's doomed explorations of the 1860s. In doing so, Bolotis captures the horrors and the possibilities of the displaced person in an alien land. The Golden Age by Luri Naara, 1986, articulates some of the silences surrounding white Australian colonial experience by exploring the effects upon a lost tribe of Anglo-Irish descent in the wilderness of Tasmania and their disastrous encounter after a century of isolation with the world of the 1930s. And David Williamson's Emerald City, 1987, is a highly personal play by Australia's most popular playwright, responding directly to the messy and awkward 1980s shift in emphasis in the Australian middle class, away from questions of political and social responsibility and onto participation in the international economy.
North Queensland, 1948, a clearing near a cane field. Lydia, Ruth and Ilse lay food out on a cloth.
You can't call this thing up the road a town. Half of it made of iron, like our barracks. There is no respite. In Germany, we lived in barracks. I can understand that. They were better than these tin drums. When it rains, you can't hear. When the sun's out, it's a sauna. At night, it rains inside from the condensation.
You'll get used to it. You got used to much worse than the war.
If this is peace, I'd rather be shot. I don't want to get used to it. Maybe it's all right for peasants.
I'm no more at home here than you are. I don't like the jungles and the stinking mud or the blood-sucking insects any more than you do. I don't understand this country, and it doesn't understand me. Oh, I don't like the way the men become raw-boned and vulgar, and I'm afraid that I'll become tired and resentful like it's women. But I can live in an iron shed and eat off an iron plate because it won't always be that way. I'll go back to a city and eat off crystal and china. I don't fight it like you do.
It's not easy, but it's not as bad as you think.
You can say that because your biggest problem is how to get from one bed to the other without being noticed. Edvard's must be blind.
I know what you all think, that I wish Edvard's was dead, and you hope I will go away before anything unpleasant happens, so you won't have to stand by and watch.
Hush, you don't know what you're saying.
I'm sorry. It's my fault. I was looking for a way to tell you that I'm moving into town as soon as Otto can find me a little flat. There's electricity. It'll be better than out here.
You're leaving us.
There's the men.
Well, you can come with me.
But there's the men to take care of.
Let them fend for themselves during the week, and on the weekends they can come visit.
A flat would be an extra expense.
Well, you'll come visit me. We'll have coffee and cake off a linen tablecloth with cups and saucers.
That'd be nice for a change, but we couldn't come often, and we'd have no transport, and you'd be alone a lot unless you mix with the town women.
With them, I'm a smiling idiot child who understands nothing.
Learn English, Lydia.
I speak English the way it's taught to me by a Dutchman, but no one understands it. I might as well be talking Dutch.
Yeah, maybe we are.
G'day. How's are you today?
Bloody crooks in the guards.
That's not English. That's the bastard language. I will speak English. This is the chair. No, that's all there is to it. This is the floors.
That is the doors.
The tea is on the tables.
It doesn't help when you have to show the butcher you want some spicy sausages. You should have seen his face.
You should have done that Aboriginal dance for him. Then his eyes really would have popped out. You put the right hip in, you put the right hip out, you put the right hip in, and you shake it all about. You do the hokey pokey and knees bend, knees bend. That's what it's all about.
The Wilds of Southwestern Tasmania, 1947. Francis lies on the ground, dirty and sleepy. There is a sudden noise and he wakes up. Peter appears, wearing his old hiking gear.
Thought I'd find you here.
Are there any others with you?
No. Are you all right?
Tired, that's all.
I'm not used to all this exercise.
Neither am I.
Betcheb?
Down by the river.
When I got to the asylum, Dr. Simon was still shaking. She said you were about to shoot Betcheb, and when she called out, you turned the gun on her.
I wanted to put Betcheb out of her misery. But when I held it against her head, I realised I should have been holding it against mine. I knew what to do. I would bring her back here. Bring her home. Well, we destroyed them.
It was a combination of events. How are we to know that the government would deal with them that way?
Does it bother you?
It does. But I've never been obsessed by them as you are or father was. How could they have survived anyway? They were pathetic remnants of what was probably an even more pathetic collection of people. They were like those Aboriginal tribes that withered away because their culture wasn't strong enough. It happens all the time in nature. In human civilizations, one big animal swallows a little one. Didn't take long for the place to return to wilderness.
Betchet enters and she smiles when she sees Peter. She hugs him.
Peter!
Hello, Betchet. Are you going to stay here? With her?
Why not?
He releases Betchet and she lies on the ground and stares contentedly at the sky.
You're mad. How the hell will you two survive out here?
They survived. Why not us? I mean, it doesn't matter anyway. Why should I go back? How can I go back after all I've seen? I mean, this is what I hate about this country. It pretends nothing important ever happened. Everything we experienced overseas, we return and we pretend we never experienced. I shot that German. I mean, not out of pity, but because I was filled with hate. All right, pretend it didn't happen. Well, you helped coordinate the bombing raids over Germany. Forget it. We obliterated a group of people, not through deliberate cruelty, but through plain stupidity and indifference. Doesn't matter. No problems, mate. Indifference is our guiding star. We'd sooner turn our attention to making a quick quid, like children amused by shiny trinkets. We'd sooner wipe out all the unpleasant memories, block our ears and pretend we can't hear the cry of pain. If we heard that cry, then our sense of ourselves would be deeper. Then we shall have reached home. We are lost, rootless people. She isn't.
You're running away.
Colin, a middle-class Anglo-Australian man in his late 30s, is raising his voice at his wife.
What's happening is that I'm getting older and I'm starting to have the nightmare that every writer gets. Ending my life as a deadbeat. Flogging scripts to producers who don't want them. And it's not paranoia. It happens. Henry Lawson was sent to jail because he couldn't pay his debts. Ended his life begging on the streets of Sydney, and did anyone care? Not one. He'd be really amused today if he could see his head on our $10 note. Cultural hero, kids study him at schools, ended his life as a joke and nobody cared. It's not going to happen to me. I'm sick of sending scripts off and waiting for the phone call that never comes, waiting patiently for it and ringing back and finally getting someone on the other end who says, sorry, they haven't had time to read it yet. Being a writer is one of the most humiliating professions on earth, and I'm sick to death of it. I want to be a producer, and I want to have money, and I want to have power. I want to sit in my office with people phoning me. I want to sit back and tell my secretary that I'm in conference and can't be disturbed, and that I'll ring right back, then make sure I never do. I want scripts to come to me, and I'll make the judgments about whether they're good, bad, or indifferent. I'll be the one with the blue pencil who rips scripts apart, other people's scripts apart, complains about the banality and predictability, groans at the cliche dialogue, mutters, there must be some good writers somewhere. Why shouldn't I have money and power? Why shouldn't I have a great big house out there? Why shouldn't I have a waterfront house like all the coked out mumblers pretending to masquerade as producers? I want you to stop telling me what I want out of my life because you are wrong. I don't want to make art films or films with a message. I want to produce a product that entertains. And I want it to make me awesomely powerful and fabulously rich.
Peter Fitzpatrick, 1986. The process of using the exotic as a means of focusing more clearly on the locales is characteristic of recent Australian plays which have presented images of Asia. Often these plays are seen as part of the new internationalism, the turning away from a preoccupation with the recognisable, which in critical surveys has succeeded the new wave as requiring apologetic inverted commas. Sex Diary of an Infidel by Michael Gurr, 1992, takes a position without much fanfare but with great impact, that Australia is part of Asia and knows us and shows us hesitantly coming to grips with our culpability in exploitation and what it means for our role in the region's future. Gerd's political insight is matched by close and deeply felt attention to the shifting emotional territory of interpersonal relationships.
Manila, the Philippines, the room of Tony, who works as a prostitute. He is packing a bag. Martin, an Australian photographer, watches him.
What will you do?
I will be there. I will be one more person.
Okay. So just look at the picture. Just freeze frame the whole thing. The American Secretary of State flies in. A bunch of Filipinos make a bit of noise outside the base. So what?
My brother asked me.
And that's all? Your brother asks you and you risk maybe what? Getting arrested. You risk maybe, I don't know, violence.
Yes.
Does Max know that you're going? Does your pimp know that his little angel is going?
No.
What are you going to say? Yankee, go home.
It's not important what I believe. My brother asked me.
Run that by me again.
Why?
Because I'm an Australian. We need to be told everything twice.
What I believe is not important. My brother asked me to be somewhere.
Okay. So it's not a political thing. What?
Nothing.
It's a family thing.
Yes.
Right. So,
it's all right. You don't have to have the next question ready. You're not used to asking questions. I can tell because I've done it before for Aussie TV. They put me in a chair and put a light behind me so you couldn't see my face. They asked me questions about Australians who come to the Philippines to fuck with kids. Do you think I need these slippers? So I told the truth, but they weren't happy. So I told them a lie and I cried. They like that better. They gave me $1,000, $500 for the Hong Kong piggy bank, and $500 for my brother.
What did he spend it on?
Why do some people pretend they don't know what's going on? Why do you pretend you don't know?
I like you, Tony.
I like you too.
Okay. So your brother buys guns. He's National People's Army.
Yes.
And you want to help him?
Yes.
And you want to go to Hong Kong and become a girl?
At Clark Air Force Base, I was a boy for the men who like boys. But the men who like boys don't like boys because they don't like that they like boys. Do you understand?
I think so.
So you get loved in the ass or you get loved in the mouth. But you get hated in the heart. And like everyone else, I want to be loved in the heart. A girl can have this. So that is what I've become. Behold is a word I read in the Bible. Behold. Behold me. It's a nice word, yes?
It's a lovely word.
Pauline Hanson, 1996. Please explain. Friedrich Nietzsche, 1875. Nearly every age and stage of culture has at some time or other sought with profound irritation to free itself from the Greeks. In 1984, the new Victorian Arts Centre opens its doors, and the first production, The Graced Stage, intended to celebrate this brand new Australian home of theatre, was a Melbourne Theatre Company production of very much the same 1947 US Medea that had toured here in 1955. Review comment, 1984. An astonishingly original creation. Wesley Enoch, 2004. I want to tackle the issue of domestic violence in our community. I am interested in Medea's choice to kill her son to stop a cycle of violence in her home. She is striving to save her son from the destiny that seems to be his inheritance. A father who is grappling with identity issues, loss of cultural practices, and alcoholism. Black Medea by Wesley Enoch in 2004 is an attempt to break Indigenous Australian drama out of the polarity of domestic versus polemic by fusing a contemporary story of Central Australian experience with the traditions of Greek drama imported by white culture.
G'day, you fellas. Tonight, we've got to sing up this story for yous, and we call upon the spirits of this land and the people who have gone before us. We've got to make it real, but it doesn't mean it is real. We just got to think it is. You got to use your imagination now. Bugger this TV shit. You got to work at it and listen. It's like one of them stories you never want to tell, because it says we're all bad. That we got badness in us all. That we got badness in us all. And I reckon we do. We battle it all the time. It's like that story that gets whispered in the corner, because no one wants to come out and no one wants to come out with it and say, things have got to change. No one wants to say, the grog's got to stop, the violence has got to stop, what we do in this country has got to stop. Like, being a warrior means being angry. But maybe being a warrior means being strong, knowing right from wrong, and doing something about it. But tonight, you're witness, judge, and jury. And we are the storytellers. It's one person's story, but it's also about everyone. And this black woman, she goes against everything that seems right, everything that seems proper. But that's what makes a story worth telling, doesn't it?
The heavens come alive.
Jason and Medea dance together.
They are sexual and intense.
You've got to imagine a settlement on the edge of the desert.
Full of kids and dogs and nothing much else.
A dusty corner of the world where the girls can't fall in love with a boy because they're related.
And they have to get promised to a man.
Like in the old way.
You've got to imagine some of the girls sitting on the veranda of the canteen when the city men come back from the mine.
Then lining up to take their turn in the back seat of the company Toyota.
No one thinks about marrying these blokes.
Maybe have a kid, but they don't expect him to hang around.
So he's had a shit shower and shave. He's in with a good chance.
The girls share around the one good dress, dance all Friday night till it's soaked in sweat, wash it the next morning and dry it in the midday sun.
So some other girl can do it all again on the Saturday.
And so it goes until the poor thing fades away, falling apart in the hands of a man.
But this man, he's different.
He's a black fella in a suit.
Working his way up the corporate ladder.
A city black with his hair wavy, bleached with the saltwater air.
All the girls laugh at him.
But she's different.
She has dreams of living in a big house with a garden in a place where sand doesn't creep in under the door.
She's got her language, she knows her dances.
But she's seen some of the world.
The best education the government could afford.
A school in a town with a uniform and French and unforgettable wealth.
But she's come back. She's been promised to this fella with the right skin.
But she knows he's never going to give her what she wants.
He's never going to get her out.
So she's been waiting.
He wants to see the world.
She wants to run away. He smells of soap and sweat.
She smells of ambition.
Our final play in this session is War Crimes by Angela Betsine, 2011. A new work which follows five teenage girls in an economically depressed coastal town. Their attempts to realise their expectations and desires bring them into conflict with accepted social narratives of identity, responsibility and belonging.
A cave in the cliffs along a beach. Jade runs in. She discovers Jordan camped there.
Told you not to come here.
Own it, do you?
Was here first.
Reckon?
Yeah. Don't you have some home to go to?
Don't you?
Everyone at school reckons you're a psycho. Stabbed a girl once, didn't you? Pencil right through her hand. Why'd you do that?
She looked at me. Stabbed her because she looked at me.
Supposed to be scared by that? You can't sleep here, right?
What's stopping me?
It's a sacred place. Aboriginal people used to camp here. For thousands of years, this was their home.
Yeah, well, it's mine now.
You can't just trash it. Leave your crap everywhere.
You me mum now.
Got to look after it.
What, you black or something?
Might be.
Don't look it.
What are you?
I'm nothing. We're not the only ones who come here, you know.
Who else?
That girl from school.
Yeah, which one?
Refo?
Ishtar?
Yeah, her and some surfy.
Oh, what, Finn?
You know him?
Yeah, Finn's cool.
Saw him, like, together and that.
Pervert.
What?
Watched him at it, did ya?
I just saw him go in here. Didn't follow him.
Yeah, righto. Reckon they're doing it?
What do you reckon?
Imagine hundreds of years ago seeing them white people coming around the headlands in those ships.
You'd shit yourself.
So what's with the look?
Jordan collects her stuff.
I mean, are you a guy or a chick? Or don't you know yet?
Jordan leaves the cave.
Hey.
The next day, Jade arrives back at the cave, breathless, rips out her earphones.
Hey.
Jordan doesn't respond.
Brought some stuff for you.
Jade tosses the stuff inside the cave.
Just biscuits in a blanket.
Am I a stray dog now?
What?
Your after-school project?
No.
Where's your gang? Why aren't you hanging with them?
I'll take the shit back then.
Nah, leave it.
Jade begins to leave.
I saw him again.
Who?
Them two. They came here the other day.
Ishtar and Finn?
Yeah.
You seen Ishtar's mum?
Yeah, really.
Looks sad, I reckon.
Why's she meeting him here? Aren't them girls allowed to have a boyfriend?
Dunno. Oh, not surfies anyways. Finn's all right, but I don't reckon his dreads are going to impress her mum.
They'd probably stone her if they knew, eh?
What?
I don't know, that's what they do.
Who?
Them refos.
Who said that?
Just heard it somewhere.
Shouldn't call them that.
Your mates do.
You sleep here every night?
Whenever.
You got a foster family, don't you? Don't you like him? My mum's not home much. You know, I'm gone running, she doesn't even notice, could be dead, yeah, hit by a truck. What about your mum? Don't you know who she is?
Nah.
It's cool.
What?
Yeah, because you could be anyone, couldn't you? Like, your mum could be, yeah, rich or famous and the rest of us all know who we are, where we're from.
Make me sound all special or something.
I feel like I sort of know you.
Yeah?
Like I've known you before.
Yeah, like when?
Oh, another life maybe? You believe in that? Maybe like in this cave, like you and me used to hang out and maybe this was our home hundreds of years ago?
Yeah?
Hey, ever seen cave paintings? Ones the Aboriginals did? None around here. No, I wish there was. Is it handprints? It's yeah, sort of a sign from them that they was here and owned this place and... Hey, come live at my house.
What?
You can't keep sleeping here. I'll tell my mum we can be sisters.
Sisters?
Whatever. We can share my room. Stuff Lara. You wanna?
Yeah, righto.
You ever kissed anyone?
Yeah.
Yeah? Do you like guys or chicks? Come on, won't tell anyone.
Guys? Chicks, I guess.
What? I didn't hear.
Chicks.
Jade grabs Jordan. They kiss. And Jade breaks away.
You know how sometimes shit gets in and... gets in your head and you can't get rid of it?
Yeah.
I try and run it out, but it won't go. It can't run fast enough. It can't run hard enough.
Raped you, didn't they? Was up there that night, then saw you on the beach. Raped you, didn't they?
Met him at the club. I was dancing with him and they were buying me drinks and asked me down to the beach. Went with him. Dumb, stupid slut went with him.
Never said yes?
No.
Raped ya?
Thought I could handle them. Tell anyone, I'll kill ya.
Two final quotes to conclude. Michel Foucault, 1971. Genealogy operates on a field of entangled and confused parchments, on documents that have been scratched over and recopied many times. Nadine Holdsworth, 2010. Theatre has the potential not just to reflect what is happening in a nation at any given time, but via its discursive, imaginative, and communal realm to contribute to the creation of the nation through the cultural discourses it ignites, the representations it offers, and the stories it chooses to tell. However, theatre that engages with the nation will have to move away from tired and impossible questions of national identity and instead rely on creative interactions and collaborations that continually make and remake the nation in the present tense. So that's the end of our presentation. I want to thank Marcel Dorney, who's the brain behind the selections. And for also I want to introduce the actors. Muriel Spearham, maybe if you could just indicate as you hear. Ray Chong Ni, Anna Sampson, Hannah Liddy, Tom Dent, and Josh Ryan. Thank you. We'll be right back.